Hello, I'm Matt Matem, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. Today, I'm joined by our online entertainment editor, Emily Murray.
Hey.
And this week, we'll be reviewing Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, and we'll also be hearing from that film's director and cast. And we'll also be reviewing La Chimera, starring Josh O'Connor, and Made in England, the films of Powell and Pressburger. Plus, on the small screen, we'll be looking at the new Doctor Who, as well as Apple TV Plus series Dark Matter. But first, Emily, have you been watching anything else this week or been to any events besides the things we're talking about?
Trying to think, because my life right now is just Doctor Who and Planet of the Apes.
But, well, there's one exciting thing I know you have seen, which is sort of outside of the film world.
Oh, yes. But... yeah, I went to go see a play this week. I moved to London last year and I feel like I've not been taking advantage of the fact that I now live in London. So I thought I'd save my pennies and go see Sarah Snook as a one-woman Dorian Gray, which was just like absolutely breathtaking. It has got like rave reviews. And, so I went in with like quite high expectations and somehow surpassed them. I don't know how she does it. She plays 26 characters and she's a narrator. So she's like narrating as she switches between other characters. I love Dorian Gray, but it's really interesting like how it's a mix of like it's her performance but also technology because they continually film her.
Okay.
So like she's projected on screens as well, like on the stage. When I say modern adaptation, it's a modern way of bringing it to life, but it's still very faithful to the book. But I was just mesmerized. I didn't really know Sarah Snook until I saw Succession. And I love Shiv Roy. I think she's one of my favorite characters. So that was a treat seeing that this week. I was very lucky to get a ticket because it's been a popular one.
I love her in Succession, and I love the book as well. So this is one I really am going to try, I think, and see if I can find just a single ticket before it finishes its run. But yeah, I'm sort of really excited to see it. And anyone I know who has seen it seems like you to have just been sort of totally blown away, not just kind of enjoyed it. That's exciting. And to be honest, I haven't really been watching much this week besides the stuff we're going to talk about. But one sort of film related thing I've been sort of consuming is I've just kind of finished listening to the audiobook version of Paul Newman's kind of memoir that was released last year, The Extraordinary Life of an Ordinary Man. And it's read by Jeff Daniels, who's kind of, you know, back in the news with his current Netflix show, which I haven't seen, I'm afraid. But obviously, he's got a kind of a great voice for it. And it's sort of an interesting book because I love Paul Newman as an actor, but it's not a traditional sort of memoir biography kind of thing in the sense that it's taken from these interviews and these kind of transcripts, these conversations he had sort of in the late 80s, early 90s. So it doesn't follow a completely standard format you might expect, you know, kind of in terms of chronology and things like that. And in some ways, I did find him quite hard to warm to at times, to be honest, which kind of surprised me. But there's quite a lot of interesting stuff to wrestle with. And in a kind of good way, it's kind of shows that the man underneath the movie star and how he kind of struggled with, you know, kind of that fame and what was kind of handed to him that way. So it was kind of interesting, but I didn't love it as much as I thought I would do. But, lots to kind of wrestle with in there. But yeah, that's it for me, really. So heading into the new releases now. And first up, we're going back to the Planet of the Apes.
Son. Your father, he waits.
Much to learn. Much to teach. There are dangers beyond our village.
What a wonderful day!
So this is Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, which, as the title suggests, is the latest entry in the extremely long-running sci-fi franchise. And in a sense, it's both a sequel and a prequel, as we're still away before the events of the original 1968 Planet of the Apes film and its famous shocking ending, but we're also kind of a few hundred years or so after the events of the recent Caesar trilogy that starred Andy Serkis and revitalized this series with some incredible performance capture VFX. And before Emily and I review the film, we're going to hear from director Wes Ball and stars Owen Teague, Freya Allen and Kevin Durand from when Emily sat down with them in London last week.
You chose a human over an ape.
This was a human place.
It is not yours.
It is now, isn't it?
The elders did not tell us everything about this world.
nor bend for your king.
Never.
I just love always returning to that world. I read in the production notes that initially you said no. No way to the idea. So I want to know what changed your mind.
Honestly, it was a story that we came up with. You know, those previous trilogy of movies, the Caesar trilogy, essentially, are so beloved. And we were such big fans. And it was such good closure. You know, beginning, middle, end, 1, 2, 3. It's a great number. You don't want to be a part four. And that's, for us, you know, when we figured out how to not be a part four, that's when suddenly the light bulb went off and we figured out, wow, there's a lot of potential here, actually, what we could do with Caesar's storyline, his legacy, and this kind of gap in time, the things that have been lost. We got to kind of rediscover our world through the eyes of Noah and his whole kind of journey of discovery in a really cool way. You know, it kind of, I think, hopefully stands on its own in amongst all these Apes movies. There's been 10 of them now. And so hopefully we're a worthy installment, you know, a new chapter in this long legacy.
And like Caesar's legacy runs throughout, but I know there was loads of rumors when this first started that it's about Caesar's son. Like, was there ever a temptation to make that movie?
For me, no. Yeah, for me, there was not. That's what I wasn't interested in doing, basically. And I appreciate some people want that. You know what I mean? But for me, that's just, it's so wrought with, you know, this dangerous waters to tread into, because you'll always be compared to those previous movies and all that kind of stuff. So there's certainly room for someone or somewhere to do some of that story that exists somewhere. But for us, we felt the right move was to kind of get some distance from the movie and see how we could start fresh with what was kind of, you know, very strong roots. You know what I mean? So it felt right for us. Yeah.
Did you talk to any previous directors like Matt Reeves, you know, before going into this?
Definitely. I mean, I had dinner with Matt early on. We were working on Mouse Guard together. So that was how we got to know each other. That's how I cast Andy Serkis in Mouse Guard too. Yeah. So we were kind of already friends, and he would give me all this wisdom while we were working on Mouse Guard, which was going to be this big kind of motion capture thing. And he would tell me all the things that he learned on Apes, you know, and little did I know that would become useful, you know. And we had dinner right before we went off to make Batman. I kind of told him about this thing and what I was thinking, and you know, he was very kind and supportive of the direction we were going. And so we felt positive and confident to move forward and try to make this crazy thing.
It feels like a fresh start, but also a continuation. How do you balance continuing that world that he likes and Matt Reeves, you know, created, but also putting your own stamp on it?
Yeah, that was the challenge, you know. Hopefully we've done it. You know, we found our way to hopefully be both our own thing, but also still kind of be tied to sort of what Rupert and Matt did together in those previous three movies. A big help is having Rick and Amanda, who wrote Rise and produced Dawn and War and produced and wrote this movie too, or were writers on the movie, along with Josh Friedman, who also they worked with on Avatar. So having a kind of DNA, similar DNA between these three, they became kind of our sort of him and them and Andy Serkis in a way too, also these godfathers of the Ape franchise that, you know, would just kind of remind us of Cage if we were steering off. Of course, you know, we're all fans of these movies, so it wasn't hard to kind of stay true to what it wanted to be. It was just a matter of trying to execute it the best possible, you know, to live up those expectations, you know.
You mentioned Andy Serkis there, because I know he worked on this one as well as a consultant. I'm just wondering what's the most important piece of advice that he gave you, because I imagine he had many words of wisdom.
Yeah, his big thing, I think, was on the actor front. You know, it's that, you know, you can't pretend to be an ape. You know, as soon as you do that, it's going to be fake. You know, so we had to spend a lot of time so that became like instinct, you know, where they could just kind of fall into that place and behave like apes and do this thing. So they weren't thinking about it, and they could just focus on good performance, just being there and present and real and honest in the scenes themselves. And then trusting the fact that the process will translate all those choices that they make on set with all these crazy dots in their face and the camera in their face, that would translate over to the CG version of themselves, you know what I mean? And that, through Weta, with the amazing work that they do. Yeah, that was a big part of it, I think, is just trusting that that's going to work if we just give it the right, you know, focus up front.
And this is intended to be the start of a new trilogy. So I'm just wondering, before you started work on this film, like, was there a conversation about how the story would plan out across three films?
No, when I first came on, there was nothing. There was just there was just me and my partner, Joe Hartwick, and then we were asked, like, what would you do next Planet of the Apes, you know? So we were starting from zero, from scratch. And of course, as you know, Rick and Amanda came on, and Josh came on, and we had Patrick come in also to help do some writing, and then you know, just the studio themselves have made all these movies, of course, in the previous movies. There's certainly, like, we're not naive. You know, this is a franchise that existed for 55 plus years, so there wants to be more if possible. You know what I mean? But we tried hard to make it its own standalone kind of movie while still delivering kind of potential and promise of more to come. You know what I mean? So we certainly have all those ideas in the back. back, you know? And hopefully, if we're lucky enough, we'll get to continue on with these characters in the story.
So, talking about the future, because I'm going to try and avoid spoilers, but there's a lot of references to space, is what I'm going to say. Sure. That's obviously a nod. Yeah, that's a nod to the original. Would you like to see, I guess, the two meet eventually?
Yeah, it's a good question. I do think that there's still many, many years in between when that Charlton Heston reality sets in, you know, where a spaceship drops out of the sky into this world of apes, you know. So the connectedness of all these movies has always been a little loose, you know what I mean? They're not totally like other franchises out there that are so absolutely carved in stone, you cannot violate this. It's always been a little loosely connected. Look, space is an important aspect of these movies. You know, there's definitely a thing to that. But in my mind, if we had our choice, you know, we wouldn't go back and remake the 68 version. We would just build all the way up to it, and then, you know, we would start over, you know, and just go back and watch the 68 version, watch all the franchise through.
And talking about the original, like, I remember watching that as a kid. My dad showed it to me.
Yeah,
and
me too.
And the end, I was like, oh, my God. Do you feel any pressure then with your final act that you have to deliver, like, a similar punch, I guess?
No, I don't think so. Once you've done it, you can't go back and do that again. So it's like we weren't even going to try. What we did try to do was literally open a door to potential of what we wanted to do, explore in the future. You know what I mean? So these movies are always about humans and apes living together or not, how they coexist, the drama and the conflict between them. That's always what makes these movies kind of tick. I think what people will come to find is that this isn't just an ape story, it's also a human story. And that's ultimately where we're going to go forward, I think, if we're lucky enough to make more, is that it's ultimately about the relationship of these two characters and how that's going to feed on itself and be plenty of drama and conflict and, you know, to explore along the way.
I like the use of I know Apes Together Strong has been used throughout, but it's interesting how it means different things to every single character throughout this film and the division that creates. So I'm just wondering, what does that phrase mean for you personally?
I think it means, you know, work together, you know what I mean? Whether that means apes together strong or, you know, species together strong, you know what I mean? So Caesar as a character and all the things that he stood for was like, you know, he's the kind of person that you want to live up to be. You know, he's powerful and strong and kind and merciful and all those things. So, you know, it was one of the tenets that we kind of carried throughout this whole movie, that, you know, this Noah character would discover what Caesar meant and the truth behind him and all the different characters that have different versions of Caesar. You know what I mean? And got to explore that a bit. And ultimately we're going to see where Noah as a character sort of fills those shoes in some small way.
Wes Balls compared your character Noah to like Luke Skywalker, Frodo Baggins. I'm just wondering, how do you feel about those comparisons? Because they're such legendary characters.
It makes sense. Like, the stories that those characters have, you know, are very much kind of a rise to heroism and to, you know, saving their people or their societies or whatever. And that is exactly Noah's story. There's pressure, for sure, but but he's absolutely right.
And talking about comparisons, I've seen your character, Proxima Caesar, compared to Thomas Edison and Elon Musk as well online.
Man, even with the bonobo face, they compare me to Elon Musk. I get Elon Musk all the time. Actually, it's very funny. When people approach me with a look in their eye where I'm like, oh, they're not meeting an actor that they might like. It's something bigger, like as if, yeah. But the fact that it comes through in that's fantastic. How do I feel about that? I did look at really charismatic speakers. I did watch Tony Robbins quite a bit. Elon, I watched Schwarzenegger when he's doing like his governor speeches.
I get that. I kind of get the comparison. Rhea, your character, most of the time she's just acting alongside, well, you guys in motion capture, you know. What's it like just being the only human character for a lot of the scenes and having to act against apes?
It was good for the role because I felt sort of, you know, left out of the ape camp. But it was, I think the weirdest thing was having to do the scenes with, so I'd do the scene with you guys and then you'd be taken out and I'd have to just act against nothing. I'd hear your voice.
Yeah.
You'd be off on the side.
Oh, it'd be like behind camera.
Camera or like whatever, but I'd have to, you know, find some sort of tree in the distance to stare at for the eye line or something, which was the most bizarre thing, having to do scenes against air.
With no scene partner.
Yeah.
I had to do such strange things, like, I really felt like a loser, you know? Like, I was having to hug air at one point, And then I had to be like, I had to drag myself, so act like someone was dragging me.
You were just covered in dirt the entire time.
Yeah, yeah.
Really dirty toes for 6 months. And, you know, it was Australia, we were in Australia, and I'd want to go to the beach, and I would be concerned of what people were going to think of my toes for 6 months. It's probably the hardest thing, yeah.
I want to talk a bit about Andy Serkis, because I knew that he worked as a consultant on a film. You guys must have worked with him. But what was the most important piece of advice he gave you, because he's such a legend in this world?
The first time that he and I spoke, he kind of helped me remove a little bit of the pressure from the fact that I was playing a chimpanzee a little bit. That's his biggest piece of advice with performance capture, is that you're still just playing a character. It's not actually that different from normal live action work. Of course, you're moving differently, or you're, you know, speaking differently, but you still do all the same stuff that you would do with any other character. And that was what he stressed to me the first time, and that really was crucial, you know, to keep in mind.
For me, I kept thinking, well, how the heck will I get human sounds through this trachea and, you know, and honestly, with Alain Gauthier,
yeah,
who worked with
ran
us
Ape School
every day, he was the artistic director of Cirque du Soleil for 25 years, and he left that position to come work with us. We were so lucky. And so he really walked us through it every day. By the time I was in my own ape school, because
right,
I came later,
kind of home, yeah.
And 4 weeks in, he asked me a question, and I was so in the body, and I didn't know what the voice was yet, and then all of a sudden I went, what a wonderful day. And the voice started to come out, and he went, wait a second, went and got his phone, filmed me talking, and sent it to Wes, and everything felt really organic through that process.
You know, he was working with us to get us in our bodies and get the anatomy right and all that, but also he brought the voice into it, and he had us, you know, interact in character early on, so that we would develop these characters and not just, you know, be generic chimpanzees or whatever.
And the improvs.
Yeah,
we would do. Like, my first day at a set, these two were shooting. In between takes, he was still in character, and I could tell that he was looking at me from a distance, and he kept inching closer to me, looking at me through the windows of cars, and then he kind of came up to me. He was, like, beckoning me. He was like, come on, it's okay, you're safe. And then all of a sudden, I went from, oh, God, I feel like such an idiot.
Yeah. No, Proximus just, like, came out.
Yeah, and you went like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh, and oh.
Yeah.
And then we ran off, and we improv for I don't know how long.
It was like 45 minutes.
Yeah, 45 minutes. And we would do this all the time, and BTS would always, not the Korean pop band, behind the scenes. That would be weird if they were recording us. And they would ask us, when do you guys shoot that scene? And we were just improvising. And then through those improvisations,
actually made it in the movie.
This is obviously intended to be a start of a new trilogy. What would you like to see next, I guess, from the future films?
I would like to see, you know, in terms of how he becomes a leader, you know, Noah, the route that he chooses to go, in terms of how he carries forward this world of apes, and what your role in that might be or might not be.
Yeah, I want to see how Noah, like, navigates what he's learned. Noah comes from this village with such a specific kind of, like,
well, it's isolationist
upbringing.
He's entirely sheltered.
Exactly, and then this movie is all about Noah kind of learning everything
truth.
All at once.
Yeah.
I want to see how you take that.
So that was Wes Ball and the cast of Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Emily, shall we dig a bit more deeply into this film now? So the basics of this story is, so we're set kind of, forget what the title card says, but it's sort of several generations.
300 years? Yeah, I think they say like roughly 300 years later, but I think the title card's many generations later.
Many generations, yeah. Mm. So, and we kind of pick up with Owen Teague's character, Noah, and he's this young ape who's part of this eagle clan. That's their thing. Yeah. They kind of raise eagles, like some people sort of raise pigeons. Mm. And basically, they come under attack, don't they, from these armoured, mask-wearing apes. And a lot of them are kind of taken away from the village. And then that kind of sets Noah off on this journey to kind of find where they've gone, which will lead him to sort of other ape tribes and sort of expand his horizons, really. So that's the kind of story. And he's got that, like, as kind of discussed in the interviews, but he has that classic farm boy sort of trope, that sort of the Luke Skywalker, Frodo kind of thing, where he's the young innocent who kind of goes off on this big adventure that will kind of shape him. But yeah, but did you kind of enjoy this film?
I really liked it. Yeah, I do like Planet of the Apes. I've read the books. I love the movies. So I was pretty excited for this one, and I was interested because there is that time period jump from Wolf of the Planet of the Apes. I think a lot of people are expecting this to sort of pick up immediately after and be about Caesar's son, but it's not. It's a whole new world. But I think it's an interesting balance of it being like a whole new world, but Caesar's legacy and what that means and how it's been interpreted by different apes. I think it's really fascinating because you have Proxima Caesar, who is our villain here, brilliant, played by Kevin Durant. I think he's just fantastic. Every time he's not on the screen, I want him on screen because he's got so much charisma and energy. So he has a bit of a different interpretation to what Caesar wanted to achieve compared to others, and I think it's an interesting exploration of that. I think it takes way too long to get to the main villain. There's
Yeah, I
some
was just
pacing
about to say
issues.
when you said you kind of miss him when he's not on screen, but he does take a
He's
long
not.
time to show up, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think it's like we've got like an hour 45 in, and then he shows up, which is quite surprising. But I love the opening scene, and I love the last act. I think the middle is a bit of a slump. Like, it's kind of stating the obvious to say, but it's gorgeous to look at. Like, this is a film made for IMAX, and it's made for the big screen. And I love being lost in that world. I don't think it's ever looked better with the performance capture. Like, I don't understand how they make like the apes like wet and how all that works. Yeah, it's dazzling to look at. I love the characters, I love the themes. My main issue is that it's just the pacing, it's just too long, at 2.5 hours.
Yeah, it's one of those things that you've obviously seen it twice now, kind of at
Yes.
this time of talking, and I've only seen it once, but I had heard a few people say that it's a bit slow to get going. So I kind of went in prepared for that. So maybe
Okay.
it didn't hit me kind of as hard as it might have done if you kind of went in completely unaware of that. But yeah, it's long. And I suppose obviously the intention is to sort of establish like a new sort of trilogy here. So kind of takes a while getting going. But yeah, it was one of those weird films for me where broadly speaking, I actually did enjoy it. And I kind of like you, I was sort of blown away by the visuals because, again, because we haven't seen one of these films for a few years, it just is incredible, kind of in terms of
Yeah.
just like the kind of texture you get on the sort of close-ups of the faces and things like that, and the fur, how that's done, and just the kind of the expressions they get from the whole kind of performance capture style. So that I was kind of sort of blown away again by that, and it's almost worth seeing it just to sort of gawp at the effects and think like,
Yeah.
how are they actually doing that? And then I really liked the world of this one, like literally the sort of physical world in that all this kind of greenery has grown up around these derelict buildings that have been left from, the humans generations and generations before. So I thought that was like a really nice sort of visual touch. And then I thought it was nice in this one that we do go to a few different places within this kind of area of the world. So you do get a few different environments. So that kind of mixes things up a bit as well. There's this kind of like nice orangutan character that
Oh,
Noah meets along the way. Yeah. He's he was a highlight for me. But
I
then it was one of those films that for me that I sort of enjoyed it without ever really getting like blown away by it, if you know what I mean.
love
And in the way that kind of the best films like really sort of grip you and drag you along with the story, this was one where I was kind of pleasantly sort of engaged the whole time, but I was never just completely like, whoa, like where's this going next? And just, it was just
him.
almost felt like it just kind of went along a fairly sort of expected path for me. But that said, like I say, I thought it was, I did enjoy it. There's some nice action scenes in it as well. It
See,
is a
I get chills with the final act. Like, generally, like my skin starts to like crawl. Like, I get chills during the final act. I think I don't want to spoil it for anyone, but I think it's a really interesting setup, shall we say, for like what could happen next. But I think that is part of the issue is that we are setting up for the future. Like, this is quite underplayed, maybe. But I did have some woe moments in terms of the story. I think it's also interesting because I don't know whose side I'm meant to be on or if there's any sides. Like, I don't really know how I feel about the apes, how I feel about the humans, because there's a question of like, should we be fighting for a world which mankind's lost? Is it just the apes' time now? But I think that's interesting that it's just not black and white, which is the same with Caesar's legacy. Kevin Durant is fantastic. Freya Allen's quite interesting. I think she comes into her own in the latter half. She's this mysterious human called May. The only thing I would say is Noah. I did really like Noah, but I don't know if he's a strong enough lead for a new trilogy, especially if you compare him to I mean, it's kind of hard to compare to Andy Serkis,
Yeah.
but he is following in those footsteps, and I don't know yet if he has the chops, shall we say.
Yeah, he's almost more of a sort of a slightly blank character almost, isn't he? Like a sort of a blank canvas character in a way for you to kind of project on. And I warmed enough to him during the film, and he has those kind of relationships within his clan, and then that he kind of gains outside as well that are kind of interesting. And we see some of their sort of customs and things as well. Like right from the beginning, they've got to kind of get an egg, and it's kind of to raise their own eagle. And it's also like, I suppose this is in keeping with the sort of recent Apes films as well, but it's a relatively harsh film in places as well, isn't it? Like they don't kind of like shy away from some of the kind of tough experiences they go through. And like you say, that there is kind of interesting stuff. And with Freya Allen's character, yeah, you're never kind of, you're not 100% sure how trustworthy she is, you know. And then you're not exactly sure, yeah, like what side to be on, which is interesting for this scale of film, I think. Yeah, I was kind of like intrigued the whole way through. I always slightly, I don't know, again, I've always got a slight problem when there is such a strong setup for the next one, because you do feel like, come on, like there's that feeling that you haven't just sat down and enjoyed the whole thing. But you know, on the strength of this, I would come back for more, definitely.
Same. I was really impressed with this, and I did enjoy it more the second time. I think because I mean the first time I saw it, I was a bit like, oh, that's a bit long, because I was aware of the pacing issues. I knew where it was going. I definitely enjoyed it more the second time. But also seeing it in IMAX is like the way to go if you're gonna go see this film.
And also just another random thing I wanted to say, but there's not so many familiar faces in this as there have been in the recent films. But I won't name this person just in case, but it surprised me that there's a kind of like character actor who sort of turns up at halfway through. And it took me a couple of minutes where I was like, is that this person? And then it was, but that kind of surprised me. But we haven't mentioned that this film is directed by Wes Ball, who has previously done the Maze Runner films, but next up he's landed the gig of making the Zelda film, which is obviously
Huge
just going to be
gig.
just absolutely enormous deal, isn't it? Going to be like finally making a film of Zelda. How do you think from this film, does that made you excited for his Zelda?
I think he's. I mean, I must admit, I haven't actually played the Zelda games. I know quite a lot about them, but never actually sat down to try play it. But from what I know about it being in a sort of fantastical land, I mean, from Planet of the Apes alone, like he's clearly got a vision for world building. I think it'll be something special. And I was actually quite a big fan of the last Nintendo movie we got, Mario. I know a lot of critics didn't like it. I thought it was really fun. So I'm pretty confident about Nintendo's movies. And I think Wes Ball, he's got an exciting future ahead now that he's helming the apes and he's
Yeah.
in demand doing Zelda.
I felt sort of similar in that, yeah, I thought, to be honest, the Maze Runner films, I remember quite liking the first one.
Yeah, I
And
don't
then
think
it
I've
kind of, yeah,
seen.
the first one kind of took me by surprise. And I was like, oh, this is pretty good as a kind of, you know, in that Hunger Games era of just like as another YA adventure thing. But I kind of liked it. And it was kind of sort of stripped back and tense and quite inventive for that kind of film. But then I've definitely seen like at least one more. I've definitely seen at least the second one, but to be honest, I barely remember it. And I actually couldn't even say for certain if I've seen the third one. I actually can't remember. So when he was first announced for Zelda, I wasn't 100% convinced that I was kind of thinking of the Maze Runner. But this, I think, this makes me think, I mean, he's clearly got a very good sense of telling this kind of big scale story with this level of VFX. And like, I'm not the world's foremost Zelda expert by any means. I know there'd be many people much more obsessive than me, but I've played a handful of them, particularly like Ocarina of Time on the N64. That was a kind of pivotal game for me growing up. I loved, I forget, I sorry, I forget the names of some of them even, but I
It's
haven't played,
Breath of the
I yeah,
Wild.
I haven't played the most recent ones, to be honest, but I loved like the Wind Waker, Phantom Hourglass. Like I really like the ones that were on the DS. I definitely feel more confident now, and just the kind of scale and of the VFX here as well that he's kind of handled, and that it feels like we kind of mentioned, it does feel like a plausible world in the sense that you get the sense that there are these different parts of the world, and you feel like they're moving through these different parts, which sometimes you don't get with blockbusters. So that made me feel kind of confident, because obviously so much of Zelda is about kind of moving around the map, going to these different realms. So that definitely makes me excited for the Zelda movie.
Yeah, I'm intrigued. I'm intrigued. I hope he makes another Apes film if they're gonna
Yes.
do a sequel. I think
He might be a
it's
bit busy now. He might just be
I
too
know
busy.
he might be too busy
He's
making
already,
Zelda
yeah.
movies.
Okay, so that is Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, which is in cinemas now if you want to check it out. And next, it's time to excavate this mystery.
Cerco la signora Flora.
Te l'avevo detto che sarebbe tornata.
Guarda, guarda chi c'è.
L'altro è l'unico amico. Taglia, grazie. Mangia.
She wants to hear what we say.
Se vuoi posso farti un corso accelerato in italiano.
Vedremo d'occhio.
It's of inestimable value. That's what we're here for. Estimate the inestimable.
Rubare le cose delle anime! Vi maledico!
This is La Chimera. Emily, would you mind setting this one up for us, please?
So this is set in 1980s Italy. We're transported back in time for a fantastical comedy drama. It's kind of hard to try and summarize the genre. We follow Arthur, portrayed by Josh O'Connor, who everyone's currently obsessed with thanks to Challengers. He's a young British archaeologist called Arthur who becomes involved in a criminal network that deals with stolen artifacts. And it's just sort of about his experiences, I guess, during this time.
And this is like a strange film, isn't it, as you kind of hinted at, because again, this was another one I went into without massive expectations or knowledge. I generally heard sort of positive things about it, but that was it. And I knew there was this kind of, you know, archaeology, stolen artifact element. But obviously in some ways that can bring to mind Indiana Jones, perhaps. But it's not that kind of film at all. Yeah, it's really, really tonally strange, isn't it? And I actually haven't seen any of the films that the director Alice Rohrwacher has made previously. Lazaro is probably her most famous film she's done to date. And obviously, it's not like it's massively mainstream, but haven't seen those yet. But she's kind of a big name on the sort of international festival circuit. It's a really strange one, isn't it? Because on the one hand, it's quite like mysterious, and there's this kind of almost like, I don't want to say spooky, but there's this sort of haunted quality to it almost.
Yeah.
And Arthur has this kind of connection to this woman who's not around anymore, kind of either dead or missing, and her presence kind of hangs over the film and his kind of dreams and things like that. So you have this kind of element to it, and there's this sort of murky underworld element to it, where I mean just a very idea of sort of raiding tombs is just a bit kind of creepy and unsettling. But then it's sort of like a weird comedy as well at the same time, isn't it? It's kind of sort of broad, and you've got these really like colorful characters, and people break the fourth wall at just very random moments, and there's kind of singing and parades and just these sort of larger than life characters. So it's a really weird mix, but I did find something very compelling about it. How did you find it?
Yeah, it's experimental, strange, bizarre, always going in new directions. And I think that will either sit right with you or you want to turn it off. Like it's either going to be like either or. I was quite compelled by it. I wouldn't say I loved the film. I think it's a bit messy at times. Like, not all of that works for me, shall we say. But I couldn't help but be, like, continually drawn to where it's going. It's like a puzzle box that you're constantly trying to solve. And I'd always rather a film push our boundaries and push us like this does, rather than play it safe. I think it's beautiful. I think Josh O'Connor is such a mesmerizing presence. He's always great, as we are discovering recently with Challenges. I can't help but be drawn by Arthur. And I loved all the stuff about the criminal network and the tombs. As you say, it's quite haunting. I also really liked his relationship with the woman named Italia. I personally, maybe it's just because I'm like a history nerd, would have maybe loved a bit more tomb raiding, shall we say. Because sometimes it feels like it's getting distracted. I think that's my main issue with it. It's like, what's a distraction? What's like, I guess, part of the mystery?
It definitely
it's
goes
really
off
interesting.
On, it goes off on tangents, doesn't it? Definitely.
But
yeah, like Josh O'Connor in particular, I was kind of sort of compelled by and sort of drawn to, because like you say, obviously Challengers a couple of weeks ago made a big sort of splash in that, but he's sort of so different here, but equally sort of kind of compelling. And again, one of those things that you think, wow, that's actually great acting. You can kind of play these two different characters, and you know, he's British, but, and he's playing a British character here, But he speaks a lot of Italian in the film. And yes. to my ear, obviously, I cannot speak Italian, but he was very convincing to me, at least.
So
that kind of impressed me as well about it. And like you were saying, I think, again, this is one where it definitely helps to go in with some kind of expectations that you are getting this slightly weird film. If you go in expecting Indiana Jones or just a really sort of straightforward romp, then I think you'll just be like, what is going on here? And you've obviously got to have an open mind to sort of looser kind of narratives, you know, and that kind of thing. But yeah, I did actually really enjoy this.
I'm new to the director. I'd definitely be interested to see the rest of her work, to see like how similar it is. I think it's something about, like, this might sound weird, but I feel like my brain has to like tune into it. Like,
yeah.
It's like a different channel. And once it had tuned in, I was like quite drawn to it. I just wasn't like wholly convinced, but I think it's worth, like, it's definitely worth a shot, especially if you want something a bit different.
I felt the same as well. Yeah. And that classic thing that I feel like I would either watching it, like, you know, if I'm intend to go back and revisit Happy as Lazaro now as well, but I feel like if I was to sort of see that and to watch this again, that again, yeah, that exactly that word, that you're kind of on that wavelength and you sort of know what you're getting into, whereas I kind of came in a bit unprepared for that, so it did take me a little while to get onto it. Just really thought there was a lot of sort of texture to the world, and like you said, it's set in the 80s, but in some ways it kind of sort of feels a bit timeless, like it almost could be any time. Like in some ways it feels more modern, in some ways it feels older than the 80s. And then I just, like, we kind of meet Josh O'Connor's character. He's sort of on a train at the beginning and he's really disheveled and his suit's pretty sort of shabby by this point. And he's apparently a bit smelly. And and then he kind of lives in this sort of really run down little kind of shack thing. There was something just, really interesting about that world. And I always think Isabella Rossellini is great when she pops up as well. And she's kind of great here as this kind of dowager type character who's like the mum of this woman who's no longer around. And again, she just has this kind of great presence and lives in this old sort of crumbling house. And there's all these kind of random people always around. So, I did like its weird energy, but it's not the most obviously mainstream film.
Yeah, it's definitely in its own little world, but I did quite like that. And I get what you mean by it being timeless. Like, I kept forgetting that it's 1980s. And it is beautiful. Like, every, like, the cinematography, the costumes, even it just have this shabbiness to it, not just the suit, but the world. It's definitely an intriguing one, but I hope people give a chance. You're either going to, tune into it or not, I guess.
So if you do fancy kind of tuning into that, that is La Chimera, which is in cinemas this Friday, the 9th of May. And now it's time for a very personal bit of film history.
They want to go beyond everyday experiences and communicate what is deep and mysterious in our lives.
I love you, June. You're life and I'm leaving you.
You said that because you love her!
I don't love anyone!
And it's something that no other art form can do. It's pure film.
Everybody happy?
They wanted to hang on to their independence, and they suffered because of it.
Why do you think it was so important for you to show somebody dying for their art?
I think because I would do it myself.
When I find it extraordinary that I knew Michael Powell, he was not only a support, but a guide. And that always leads back to those films he made with Emmerich.
So this is Made in England, the films of Powell and Pressburger. And goes without saying, this is a documentary about Powell and Pressburger, the Archers, this very famous filmmaking duo. But almost as much, it's kind of a Martin Scorsese documentary as well, because he's kind of credited as presenting, like it says, presented by Martin Scorsese. But he narrates and hosts the whole thing, and he's kind of talking to camera most of the time. So much of it is his memories of them, and he kind of had this relationship with Michael Powell. And it kind of goes right back to Scorsese's childhood when he's watching their films as a kid, kind of who spent a lot of time indoors. From there, it kind of just, we follow fairly chronologically through the films and through their sort of life experiences. There's perhaps understandably a bit more focus on Michael Powell than Emmerich Pressburger, perhaps because of Scorsese's relationship with him. Yeah, it's sort of fairly straightforward as far as documentaries go. It doesn't sort of reinvent the wheel. But one, it's just interesting. I think whether or not you're familiar with the films, it's kind of easy to kind of get into and follow along. I mean, to be honest, you would listen to Martin Scorsese talk about any film, really, wouldn't you? Let alone something he's kind of as passionate about as these films. Yes, but I'd say whether or not you're kind of very familiar with the Archer's work, it's easy to get into because there's a lot of clips. So if you're not familiar, you can kind of find your way. And if anything, if you're kind of a massive scholar of them, then you might even find it too sort of too clip heavy and not enough, you know, analysis and context perhaps. But yeah, I actually really enjoyed it. And kind of, as always, these things do, it makes you want to revisit those films. Yeah, it's just very interesting getting Scorsese's take on it all, really. You haven't seen this yet, Emily,
no,
have you?
No.
Like, are you kind of familiar with their work much? Or
I've seen one of them. I've seen A Matter of Life and Death, which my dad showed me growing up, which I thought was brilliant. I must admit, it's a failing on my behalf. I need to watch more Poirot and Pressburger. So that's why I find it interesting that you said that you don't have to be super familiar with their work. Because I think I'd be worried about watching something like this, since I don't know, like I haven't seen The Red Shoes, etc. Like I've only seen one of their films. But you're right that Marty, just the way he talks about cinema is like just addictive. Like you could just listen to him for hours. I don't know if you went to the BFI talk with him.
Yes, yeah.
Last year, but I was also there. But I think I overran by like an hour because they were just were like, because I had an interview after and I just remember sitting there and being like, I really want to listen to Marty talk, but I also have to leg it. Because he just, the way he tells stories, like not just for his films, but just in general, is just mesmerizing. Like he loves cinema. I can listen to him talk about anything. So yeah, definitely keen to see this one, but I definitely need to watch more Poirot and Pressburger beforehand, maybe.
Yeah, and it's just interesting. It's interesting how their sort of filmmaking relationship worked and kind of, you know, that was something which was kind of new to me, getting some more info on how they kind of divided things up. And it was just also interesting, obviously, given how long ago they were working, some of the contextual stuff like the films they were making during the war and post-war, some of the issues they ran into. It felt like in some ways surprisingly modern in terms of like some stuff to do with like studios not getting films and films being recut and them making these films that are sort of seen as quite subversive for studio films as well. And then ultimately Powell goes on to make Peeping Tom, which was obviously kind of extremely controversial and sort of kind of ended his filmmaking career in that sense. So yeah, so there's a lot of interesting context there. And again, I know we keep talking about sort of length of films, but it's fairly long. It's kind of over 2 hours, but I didn't find it dragged at all. I didn't find myself looking at my watch or anything like that. So this to me was, yeah, it was just very solid. And like I say, it's kind of as much, whether you're a fan of Powell and Pressburger or Scorsese, it's as much a Scorsese film really, because he really does bring in sort of specific examples of his films where he was kind of inspired by things that they did. So that's just kind of cool to see that and hear him talking about that. And yeah, if you are a kind of Scorsese fan, it just obviously will no doubt fire you up to sort of look back at some of these films and what went into them. Yeah, so it's just a very solid, very easy to watch documentary. If you do fancy that, that is Made in England, the films of Powell and Pressburger, which is in cinemas from Friday the 9th of May. And now coming up, we're going to actually talk about a couple of upcoming TV shows, starting with this one.
Here we go.
To my extraordinary wife, Daniela, I do not deserve you.
That's true.
A man of science. He is married to the woman of his dreams, and they have a good life.
Have a good day.
Coffee to go.
Oh my gosh, you're my hero.
Until one night, he doesn't make it home. When he regains consciousness, everything has changed.
I don't know, it sounds like he's crazy.
I'm not crazy.
So this is Dark Matter, which is a Apple TV Plus series, which is created by Blake Crouch, who's actually based on his own novel. So, I mean, fair enough to him there. Good effort. Basically, I was very intrigued when I heard just the basic premise of this, because I always find it fascinating, this idea of multiverses, parallel realities, you know, and sort of everything everywhere all at once. This idea that just like, you know, when you make a decision, what changes and what could have been, you know, and imagining all these other possibilities, that kind of sliding doors idea has just always sort of fascinated me. So this is kind of playing around in that, in a sort of sci-fi kind of way, where we meet Joel Edgerton's character, Jason, who's a sort of a professor living in Chicago. He lives a sort of, you know, for want of a better word, a sort of ordinary life. Like he lives with his wife, led by Jennifer Connelly, and his son, who's played by Oakes Fegley, which kind of surprised me because that's one of those things that, you know, when you see a child actor that you know from like Pete's Dragon and Wonderstruck, yeah. and then suddenly he just looks older, like, he's like, whoa, he's literally like grown into an adult. But so that he has this kind of sort of family life here. He's teaching students, he kind of teaching them about Schrodinger's cat as a way to kind of set up the themes of the show. But yeah, he lives this fairly just, yeah, normal life, and he's kind of got a friend who's works in a similar field, who's kind of created this massive business, made loads of money. He's kind of been sort of tempted to go and work there. But then what happens, you know, within this first episode is we see him kind of, he's out late, but then he kind of, on his way home, he's sort of bundled off by this mysterious masked figure who we don't know who it is, but, you know, you can possibly guess, you possibly will recognize the voice as well.
Yeah.
But then basically the whole premise is that another version of him from another timeline has kind of found a way through and is kind of looking to effectively sort of take over his life. That's where we kind of start. And I've only seen the first couple of episodes at this point, and this is what's currently available to watch on Apple TV. And then they'll be dropping new ones weekly. I think there's 9 in total. Basically, the old Jason has been sort of thrown into the other sort of timeline. And yeah, we just kind of watch how these two things unfold in parallel. And so you're kind of getting Joel Edgerton, who's, again, just, I find, just immensely watchable actor. He's kind of doing these two different roles, which is just enjoyable to see him doing that. And then you've got Jennifer Connelly's doing a couple of different roles as well, because obviously in this other timeline, she's gone down a different path. They haven't kind of got together. In that timeline, he kind of went off to follow his career, basically. So he didn't kind of stay with her. So there's that element to it. 2 episodes in, I definitely feel intrigued to watch more. As the Apple TV Plus shows often are, it looks very slick. I don't know if you do the same, but I always slightly roll my eyes when people use iPhones and iPads in them, because I just wouldn't notice it if it was not an Apple TV Plus show. Apple TV Plus show, you're like, okay, you're getting the iPad in there. But yeah, it looks very nice. It's kind of this sort of Philip K. Dick star world, where when he kind of comes out on the other side and he's in this weird like science sort of lab, I suppose, where they've been doing all this experimenting. I like that, where it's that kind of pulling the curtain back of this weird kind of tech that's going on behind the scenes. I like that. The one thing I kind of came away after just watching 2 episodes is, and I feel this with a lot of TV shows these days, maybe it's just me, but it felt like the premise could have worked as a film. I was wondering, like, they do spend the kind of setup that's gone through in the first kind of 2 episodes, you feel like it could have been set up more quickly in a film. But that said, I still was intrigued by it, and we'll be watching more, definitely.
Yeah, I'm intrigued to see this one. I think Apple do some really interesting, well, actually, I haven't seen any of them, but like, they seem to want to have a focus on sci-fi TV, because they've got, is it For All Mankind? They've got Siler, they've got Foundation. They seem to be really interested in making more mature adult sci-fi TV shows. Siler is meant to be really good. I've not seen that one.
I hear nothing but good things about For All Mankind as well, actually.
Yes, yeah. And
I've
Foundation.
Never seen it myself, but
Foundation is just meant to be like super duper complex, and I worry about my brain won't be able to take it. But Dark Matter, I love Joe Edgerton. He's in one of my favourite films of all time, Warrior, with Tom Hardy. Yes. I just think he's always mesmerising. I want to see this one because I think Joe Edgerton's sci-fi. And I think it's interesting that Blake Crouch, who wrote the book, is the showrunner in this one. I think it's quite rare that we have. Normally they're like producers or writers, but not the actual showrunner. So it seems to really be like his baby, I guess. Like, he's really sort of wanting to bring it to screen. So yeah, I'm intrigued by it.
Yeah, that surprised me as well, actually. But yes, I'll definitely continue to watch that. And so if you fancy giving that a go, that is Dark Matter. And the first 2 episodes are streaming now on Apple TV Plus, and there'll be further episodes dropping weekly. And now it's time for some timey-wimey shenanigans with this.
Give me the loving!
Where did he come from?
I don't know, he sort of popped up at the right moment. And then he spoke about time travel.
Ruby, the one that knows my secret.
I have the whole universe at my fingertips.
And I'm all on my own. I'd love it if you came with me.
Who are you?
I'm the Doctor.
So that is Doctor Who, Emily, where are we now in the universe? I'm sort of not up on Doctor Who at
Universe.
all, as you'll find. So kind of, yeah, we've got a fairly new Doctor. Is this like the is this his first proper series now, shooty after appearing in the specials?
So we had Russell T Davies is back, who brought us Doctor Who back in ages ago, basically, with Christopher Eccleston. We had the free 60th anniversary specials, Christmas special last year, and which introduced Shooty Gatwick's 15th Doctor, but this is his first full season. He's the 15th Doctor, traveling through space and time with companion Ruby Sunday, played by Millie Gibson. And it's interesting because it is continuing, from past seasons, but also this has been called season one. So they are treating it as sort of like a new chapter. I guess it's the first time it's been made sort of available fully internationally through Disney Plus. So it's BBC here, Disney worldwide. So I've seen the first two episodes because it starts with a double episode premiere this Saturday. So there's Space Babies and The Devil's Court, and then it'll be weekly. I know, Space Babies. It's interesting titles. Yeah, Space Babies, Devil's Court, and then it'll be weekly episodes for the rest of the season. So Space Baby sees the Doctor and Ruby land on a spaceship, and you never guess what it's filled with. It's filled with space babies,
Are they
and a
literal
monster.
babies, like?
Literally, they are babies. They are babies that talk, and they're in space, and they're very unsettling. And then you've got The Devil's Chord, which is episode two, which sees the Doctor travel back in time to the 60s to watch the Beatles record their first album at Abbey Road. It's an interesting double episode premiere for sure. I did like both episodes. Well, I thought Space Babies was fine. I really liked The Devil's Chord. Space Babies, as you can probably tell by the name, is very dumb, very silly, very childlike humor, loads of fart jokes, very whimsical. So I think that will put some people off, but also like I think it's quite a nice reminder that this is a show made for families. Like it is made for kids. At the end of the day, I know Doctor Who's a very serious. There's all the Whovians are probably going to yell at me, but like it's a silly kids show really about a man traveling in a blue box through space and time. My main issue with Space Babies is that I didn't mind the childish fart jokes and humor. It's just it didn't quite sit right with the main villain, who's like basically like a it's quite xenomorph like. It's very alien. So you got this sort of like alien like villain called the Bogeyman, and then you've got talking babies and fart jokes. Like it doesn't quite mix very well. But it wasn't a bad episode. Like I still had fun with it. I think some people might hate that though. And then The Devil's Chord is much better. It's a bit more mature. You've got Jinx Monsoon plays this villain called Maestro, and it's a really different baddie from what we've had before. And the use of music's really interesting. I don't want to spoil it, but I'm just going to say that it's very clear Russell T Davies. He's probably seen Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. When we talk about musical battles, I thought Jinx Monsoon is just electric as Maestro. One thing I do want to say though about both episodes is that Shooty Gatwa and Millie Gibson are just mesmerizing. They're just absolutely fantastic. The chemistry that they have is electrifying. They're addictive to watch. They're clearly having the best time ever making this. So watching them means you're having the best time ever. Shooty particularly brilliant. Like every line is just delivered perfectly. And whilst he's fun, like there's a serious side as well. And there's some interesting teasers. This is gonna be nonsense to people who don't watch Doctor Who, but Russell T Davies has said that the overall arc of this season will be about Ruby Sunday, who was abandoned as a baby on Christmas Eve. And we do get like it lingers over both episodes. Like we're clearly building into something. And we also have the fact that the doctor sort of not moved on from the trauma of his past, but he's put the other doctor, David Tennant, in rehab essentially. So he has a fresher energy, but also he's kind of owned the fact that he's now an orphan. He's a foundling, which is a continuation of a storyline called The Timeless Child, which is quite a controversial one in Doctor Who fandom. But I quite like that they're owning it. Because Ruby's an orphan, the doctor's an orphan, they have like quite a unique bond that maybe we haven't seen before. Yeah, Shooty and Millie are just fantastic. So even if you maybe don't enjoy the sort of whimsy nature of Space Babies, like their energy's enough to like get through it. I'm really excited for the rest of the season. We've got a Bridgerton-esque episode coming up, directed by Loki's Kate Herron.
Oh, cool.
So I think that's really cool that she's got involved. And Stephen Moffat, who, worked on Doctor Who moons ago, he returns for an episode called Boom, which sees the Doctor become trapped when he steps on a landmine. So I
Oh,
think this
okay.
is an interesting double bill. Space Babies didn't completely work for me, but I did enjoy it. Devil's Court, I thought, was great, but I think it sets up the season really well and shows like how wide and varied, I guess, Doctor Who can be. I do get though why they are doing a double episode premiere because yeah, people
I
might
was
be a
going to ask actually,
bit.
do you think that is because maybe like the Space Baby seems a bit lightweight, so kind of you need the sort of a heft of the Devil's Cord to
I
let
think
people
so.
know they're sort of serious or whatever?
Yeah, it is like super lightweight. But again, like it is a family show. Think of Space Babies as sort of Swiss Army Man meets Alien because it is got like sort of whimsical fart jokes and then the scary alien like villain. It's just that tone just didn't quite work. But yeah, I think Space Babies is such a lightweight entry. That's why you need something like the Devil's Court to be like, we are building to something quite special. But I love Doctor Who and I'm really glad it's back on screen. And I think Shooty is just incredible. Like just already has just made his doctor
Really.
one of the best for sure.
So I really liked him in Sex Education. That's obviously the main thing I know him from so far. But it's one of those weird things that like people always find this weird if like I'm in the US and they find out that I don't like Doctor Who and I don't really like follow a football team because I feel like I'm sort of, yeah, being very unpatriotic. But I've always struggled to get into Doctor Who, and to be fair, I haven't really watched that many episodes. I think I've seen the first ever episode, and then I've seen a few randoms in between. I definitely watched at least one David Tennant episode because I was like, years ago, I was like, it's just because it just sounds like something I would like. I like sci-fi. A lot of people I know like it. I like kind of geeky things. Yeah, I'm not shy of kind of geeky, nerdy stuff. But for some reason, I just always find it a bit hard to get into. And I did wonder, like, how do you think? Because obviously you mentioned the season one aspect. Is this a good time to sort of jump in afresh? Because it does feel daunting sometimes that there's so much sort of history to it.
I think so. I think as I said, it does continue storylines such as the Timeless Child arc, which Chris Chibnall did through the Jodie Whittaker era. But like you don't really need to know that arc. You just need to know that the Doctor's an orphan, which he makes clear in episode one. So I think this is a good entry point, although I guess you probably would have to watch the Christmas special to sort of see the introduction of the companion Ruby Sunday. So, but interestingly, actually, if you watch it on Disney Plus internationally, the Christmas special is listed as episode one of the new season, whereas here it's Christmas special and then Space Babies is episode one. So they are sort of treating the Christmas special, I guess, as episode one. But I think this is a good time to jump in. But also, if it hasn't worked for you in the past, like I don't think it'd work for you maybe now because it's
More
just
of
the
the
same,
same, is it? Yeah.
more the same. But I quite like Doctor Who. I did fall off during Chris Chibnall era. I thought Jodie was great. I just didn't really like the stories. So I'm excited for Russell to be back. But yeah, it's funny what you said about how Americans, when they're like, what do you mean you don't watch Doctor Who? Because it's so British. And I think there's a lot of concern about the fact that it's got Disney funding and support now that maybe it's been Disneyfied. And it is very glossy. Like it's never looked better. But like to me, it's still Doctor Who. Like it's not changed at all. I'm excited to see the rest for sure. Especially Stephen Moffat's episode, Boom, just because I love his
Yeah,
writing.
that's kind of so. Would that be the first time him and Russell T. Davies have kind of effectively crossed over and sort of worked together? Because in my mind, as a non-Doctor Who fan, I think of them as like separate kind of eras almost
I mean,
of the modern kind of Who.
Who fans might yell at me if I get this wrong, but I think Stephen Moffat wrote like the Weeping Angel episode. Like he was
Okay,
a
so
writer, he's written
he's not
stuff.
completely gone away from it.
No, but I think it's really nice that Russell's invited him back to work on this one. He also invited Chris Chibnall back, who was the last showrunner. But Christian was busy writing a book, so hasn't returned. But he has paid homage to him by continuing some of those story arcs. And I think that's nice that like they are, inviting back previous writers and new ones like Loki's Kate Herron. I think a lot of people said Loki is Marvel as Doctor Who,
Yeah,
so seems like
interesting.
a good fit. Yeah, very fun. Just if people don't enjoy Space Babies, don't worry. Devil's Court is very different and really good. Yeah, I'm excited to see the rest. I think definitely the right choice to do a double episode premiere for sure, though.
Cool. Well, maybe based on everything you said, maybe this is a good time for me to give it another go and then maybe find I don't like it again. But I'll give it another go because, yeah, it does seem like a good time to jump in. Yeah, so we're kind of nearing the end of the podcast now. But what would you say your film of the week is, or would it be show of the week this week?
I did love Doctor Who. I think Doctor Who fans, obviously they're going to watch it. It's a really exciting time to be a Doctor Who fan. But I think for me, I think Planet of the Apes deserves to be seen on the big screen. So if you are going to go to the cinema, like go see Planet of the Apes, even though it's not incredible. Like, I think it is dazzling. It's worth seeing alone for the visuals. Mm. I'm glad I've managed to see it twice so far.
Mm.
Will I go see it a third time? No. I'll wait for the DVD, but I would recommend that.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes in the cinema for sure. But then I think Chimera is the one I'm more likely to sort of revisit and kind of dig into again, if you'll excuse the pun. Just because it feels like there's just more to kind of unlock there. But yeah, I think Apes is a very, very enjoyable cinema experience. And again, one of those to me, which I always think about, but I think you get your money's worth if you go to the cinema to see that. There's kind of, you know, action, adventure, interesting characters, looks good, you know. So it's a very solid blockbuster to me, especially as it's like, might surprise people as it comes after as it comes after this kind of great trilogy, and, you know, had Matt Reeves worked on the last two. So that had, you know, had a lot to sort of live up to. And it is a very sort of solid new take. It doesn't feel like a low rent spin-off or anything like that, I wouldn't say. Right, and we're approaching the end of the podcast now. Don't forget to check out the current issue of Total Film Magazine featuring Furiosa, which is on shelves now. And also don't forget, if you take out a subscription, you can get instant digital access to that issue before your first print copy arrives. We're currently running an offer where you can get your first six issues for $9.99. So if you fancy giving that a go, I'll drop a subscription link in the podcast notes. And talking of subscribing, if you like this podcast, we would love it if you could subscribe on your podcast app of choice. It really does make a difference and means that you'll never miss a new episode. And remember, you can contact us on our social media channels or email us via totalfilm@futurenet.com. But before we go, just time for a quick question based on Planet of the Apes, obviously. But who is your favourite movie ape, Emily?
I feel like it's a cheat answer saying Caesar. That's a boring answer, isn't it? But Caesar is such an incredible character. I love what Andy Serkis did. Also, do you like the orangutans in Planet of the Apes films? Like Raka, we sort of said, is great in this one.
Mm.
Morris. If we're going to wide into non-Planet of the Apes and monkeys, I always loved King Louis from Jungle Book.
Who
I remember someone once describing as the Tony Soprano of Disney movies, because he has this sort of gang and makes shady deals. I loved Jungle Book growing up and I always liked King Louis. But I know he's not an ape. That's cheating. So I guess it's Caesar.
Well, I was thinking very broadly with apes with this question, because I was going to say another Andy Serkis ape, but King Kong. And it's one of those films I haven't seen this. I haven't seen this in years, Peter Jackson's King Kong. But, and I almost, one of those films that I almost don't want to revisit in case I kind of have gone off it a bit. But I just absolutely loved it at the time. And I loved Lord of the Rings. And then I was so excited about King Kong coming out. And obviously, Peter Jackson did all these kind of video diaries where they just documented the making of it in such kind of granular detail in the run-up, which I feel like is something that's never really been done before or since, going into quite as much detail as they did. But they were releasing these kind of like weekly little videos about various aspects of the production. And I just loved the film. I just remember finding it really emotional. And I loved kind of just the different parts you got to that film as well. And then obviously Andy Serkis was just coming off the back of Gollum then. And so to then know that he was kind of doing the motion capture for Kong, I just sort of love that. He'd be my pick, but with the slight caveat that I haven't revisited it yet, just in case it's aged badly. There you go. That's my ape. But that's all from us this week. So thanks very much for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Windmill, windmill for the land, the forever hand in hand. Take it all out on your stride. It is taking falling down. Love forever, love is free. Let's turn forever, you and me. Windmill, windmill for the land, everybody in. Laughing gas, these hazmat, fast cat, lining them up like ass crack.